Hey, good evening, everybody. So tonight, we are all in for a real treat. And the reason why we are in for a real treat is other than his nephew, who apparently is in here with us tonight. How many people have ever heard of Rabbi Leib Lankfus? Who? Exactly. He's the person we're speaking about tonight. Lankfus. L-A-N-G-F-U-S. Maybe another S. Anybody? You have. Two. You haven't. Nobody's heard of him. That's why we're in for a real treat. Because out of all the personalities that we have discussed this year and that we're going to discuss this year in this course, this is the most unknown out of all of them. So the good news is that we're going to learn about someone who really hopefully brings someone's legacy back to life, who has largely, at least in our circles, remained anonymous. And to me, that's a real highlight because I think that's part of the reason why we're doing this course in the first place. The difficulty is that there's not an enormous amount written about him. So we're going to do our best through a lot of research and through piecing together a few different things to really bring Rabbi Lankfus to life. I want to dedicate this class. Obviously, we're enormously grateful to the Firestones for sponsoring this entire lecture series. But tonight in particular is meaningful for me. It's my wife's tanti, her great aunt, which sounds a little bit removed, but they were very, very close. And it's her yahrzeit. Now, the reason why that's particularly auspicious tonight is because she and several of her sisters, well, all of her sisters went through Auschwitz. Only a few of them came out alive. And so it's particularly meaningful tonight on her yahrzeit to be speaking about what took place in Auschwitz. And again, I think it'll be meaningful, hopefully, for everyone as well. I also want to dedicate tonight to all of the martyrs, certainly those who went through Auschwitz. I know I am named, my Hebrew names are Gavriel Pinchas, two of my grandfather's brothers, both of whom died in Auschwitz. I believe they definitely died in the Holocaust, at least one of them went through Auschwitz and didn't make it out. So tonight is dedicated, Leulei Nishmas, all of these Kedoshim, all of these precious souls that are no longer with us. What we're going to do is do a little bit about Auschwitz, which I would imagine many of us are familiar with, either because of family stories or because of just general research. Everything we're talking about tonight is to build up to ultimately we come to Rabbi Lankfus. We're not going to get to Rabbi Lankfus until about the 18th slide. So you're going to have to bear with me, and there's a reason, there's a method to how we're going to build the class. But everything that we're going to talk about is so that we understand exactly the places, the people, the scenarios of which we're going to get to by the time we reach the personality of Rabbi Leib Lankfus. The last introductory comment I would say, and I introduced Rabbi Zemba a little bit this way as well. This is not meant to be an academic class tonight. We'll talk about research, we'll talk about testimony, we'll talk about documentation. We're going to talk about a lot of things. But more than anything, in my personal preparing of this class, I found this to be the most emotional class I think I've prepared since I came to BRS. And you'll see when we read the excerpts that you have in front of you, which we're not going to get till the end of the class, I think you'll see why I found it so emotionally taxing and grueling to prepare about our personality tonight, Rabbi Leib Lankfus. So until we get there, let's start with a little bit of a poem. This is a poem by an anonymous woman who lived and died in Auschwitz. And the poem says as follows. Someone will say it was only a year, 3 times 4 months. But I say there were days and nights without end. Each day had 12 hours. Each night, I assume that's something. How many? I assume that's a mistake. Each night, 1,100 minutes. Each minute, 60 seconds. And each second, a measurable suffering. Now, why do I share that with you? Because I find that poem, which is obviously translated from Yiddish, is a helpful reminder that when we talk about dates, we'll talk about from September to October. We'll talk about from July to October, right? So to us, 2-3 months is not a long period of time. But I find it helpful to place this entire narrative into context to remind ourselves of just how grueling every single second of life was for the people that passed through those horrible gates of Auschwitz. What do we know about Auschwitz? So key dates. The first, what they call in academia, the first shipment is June 14th, 1940. Not Jews, it's political people who are, political opposition, economic crimes. They first arrive into Auschwitz. By midsummer 1941, Auschwitz first began to function as a death factory for the murder of the innocent. First mass murder, and again, I'm saying these words, and it feels almost like an out-of-body experience just to say them. But the first mass murder was July 28th, 1941. Of course, at the time, the Germans had not yet perfected their method of mass murder, which doesn't take place until a number of months later, when they first experiment with Zyklon B. And again, Auschwitz was only liberated in 1945. So close to 4 years, Auschwitz was in use. And again, you have there on the right the picture. This is the first prisoner transport on June 14th in 1940. What do we know about Auschwitz? So just by show of hands, how many people have been there? So, oh, really? The rest of you should go. But, you're afraid? I'll tell you an interesting story. When I went, so not everyone was thrilled in my family that I went. So it goes, okay? So Auschwitz was not one camp. Auschwitz was about 40 different sub-camps. Three of them are the most famous ones. So you have Auschwitz, oh, I don't have a pointer. You have Auschwitz 1, this is the main camp. When you see that iconic picture of the railroad tracks coming into Auschwitz, right, you see that a lot with the March of the Living and the planes flying ahead. That's Auschwitz 1. Auschwitz 1 was largely used as a office. It was the command center for the SS and the entire operation of Auschwitz. When we think about Auschwitz, we're talking about Auschwitz-Birkenau, which is over here, and that is the death camp, right? The majority of people that died in Auschwitz died in Auschwitz 2, and then off to the right you have Auschwitz 3 as well, which was an industrial labor camp. So again, when we talk about tonight, it's going to be Auschwitz-Birkenau, which is Auschwitz 2. But it's important to know, just it wasn't one camp. It was a series of camps. Okay, what do we know about the camp? So here's a map of the camp. So you have here the main railroad tracks as they come in. And in the back, again, you can look at this on your own at the end. I have the PowerPoint. But for us, what's going to be important, unfortunately, is 2, 3, 1, and... Right, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 here. So 2, 3, 1, 4, 5, which are the five crematorium. The five gas chambers and crematorium all in the same area that existed in Auschwitz. What we're going to be talking about tonight a lot is crematorium 1, 4, and 5. And you'll see later on, obviously, why we're talking about. But I want everyone to have at least a little bit of an appreciation for the size of the camp, right? Camp Canada, obviously, was in a, you might have heard about before. That's where a lot of, where they separated through people's belongings, etc., right? Why did they call it Camp Canada? Anyone know? Because Canada was considered to be a wealthy country. And that's where they collected people's wealth. That's where they collected the belongings. So they called it Canada, and they spelled it with a K. Okay, here you have the same map, just to give you a different perspective. This, of course, is a tragic map. Why is this a tragic map? This is taken from a plane. Who flew the plane? The Allies. This is taken from the Allies. Of course, who had the opportunity. This, you see, is dated August 23rd, 1944, which means the Allies had the opportunity about 5 months before Auschwitz was liberated. They could have bombed the tracks. Of course, we've had classes about that in the past. Here you have the railroad station into the camp. And again, back here you have crematorium 2 and 3. Canada camp. Here's the showers where they tricked people into thinking they were going for a shower or a sauna. And here you have crematorium 4 and 5. Again, most of what we're going to talk about tonight is going to take place in this area over here, okay? arriving at Auschwitz. So just a couple of facts. So you have that between 1942 and 1944, Jews were brought to Auschwitz from 13 European nations. It's just astounding. The numbers are astounding. Hungarian Jews, I share this, obviously, every Jew from every country was important. It happens to be that my wife's family all came from Hungary, so I'm particularly sensitive to that. But Hungarian Jews began on May 15th, 1944, and continued till October. Not a long period of time. That's why I shared the poem at the beginning. Every minute, every second was torturous, right? 400,000 Jews. It's just an astounding number in a very short period of time. When you think of the extermination of all of Hungary, or most of Hungarian Jewry, it took place at the tail end of the war, and it happened relatively quickly.
6 months.
6 months, right? In a relatively quickly period. Relatively quick period. The Sonderkommando. Sonderkommando were a group of individuals, usually people who were strong and capable and healthy, and they were plucked out of the line, and they were placed in charge of the gas chambers and the crematorium. And they had a number of roles. They had to extract gold teeth. They had to ensure the undressing of victims. They had to cremate the bodies. They had to heat the furnaces, and they had to clean out the furnaces. This was, of all of the jobs in Auschwitz, the worst and most miserable and horrific job to have. You see here, many of them committed suicide. They simply couldn't bear the sights, the smells, the sounds that they experienced and that they witnessed. There's a book, I forgot his name right now, but it's just testimony of the Sonderkommando. And if you want a good book to read on Tisha B'Av this year, take that book, because it is every page. You'll just want to cry more and more. If you're not a reader, you can go online. We're going to watch an excerpt from it later, probably. We'll see how we're doing on timing. But the Yad Vashem, it's either Yad Vashem or the U.S. Holocaust Museum, one of them has a 13-minute clip of just interviews with four members of the Sonderkommando about their experiences. It is unbelievable. And I don't mean that in like an extraordinary way. I mean it as literally unbelievable. As someone who is a generation younger than the majority of people in this room, I simply cannot wrap my head around it. No matter how many times I've heard stories, no matter how many Pesach Seders my mother-in-law, and before that when Ariel's Tanti was alive, they used to tell us stories, I can't wrap my head around it. I simply cannot wrap my head around it. In fact, when I was younger, I never wanted to go to school on Yom HaShoah because I found it to be such a depressing day. I couldn't fathom that level of evil ever existed in the world. And every year, I would beg my parents not to send me to school the next day, because after all, school's supposed to be fun. Who wants to go to school and be depressed all day? And every year, my mother would sit me down and she'd have the same conversation where she would talk about Jewish guilt. What would she tell me? If you don't go to school, who won? Hitler won. And so she would guilt me into going to school every year. But this is exactly it, right? So the Sonderkommando had the most grueling, horrific jobs in all of the camp. One of the great controversies surrounding the Sonderkommando is the moral composition of this group. If you are intellectually honest with yourself, I'll put it to you this way. I don't know what I would have done. I'd like to believe I would have done certain things, certain ways, but you simply can't judge those who lived in those horrific time periods and were being asked to do bestial things, inhumane activities. But one of the conversations that surrounds the Sonderkommando that you will see in any book that describes them and talks about them is the moral composition of them. These people were the ones who were shuttling people into gas chambers. These people were the ones who were burning the bodies. They were extracting teeth. They were shaving hair. They had the most horrific jobs in all of Auschwitz. And so part of you says to yourself, why didn't they do something about it? Why didn't they revolt? Why didn't they rebel? Why didn't they kill themselves instead of allowing themselves to partake in this? And the answer is, it's not so simple. So I just want to share with you a couple of quotes that I found particularly meaningful And that I think, again, helps paint the picture. And again, everything I'm sharing with you is not haphazard. It's building up. So you'll appreciate at the end of the class why we're doing what we're doing along the way. But let's read a couple of these statements, just to give us a little bit of sense of who these Sonderkommando were, the types of jobs they were being asked to partake of. So this is from Olga Wormser, who was in Auschwitz, and she's describing the Sonderkommando. She writes, "The Sonderkommando was no school of virtue. Most of the Sonderkommando were not among the moral elite of the camp. But how can one expect that under such circumstances, human beings would not become animals or would not become robots, dragging corpses, burning bodies, and perhaps encountering dear, familiar faces?" One of the horrific tactics, if you read the testimonials of the Sonderkommando, one of the horrific tactics that the Nazis did was that they specifically placed a Sonderkommando in charge of a chamber that involved his family members, so that he would have to go in and see his loved ones. And that's how that was psychological warfare. Talks about being robots here. One of the testimonials on the video, I'm not going to show this with you tonight, but I'm happy to share the link with anyone who wants. But the first interview on that video, he describes what it means to have been a robot. And he basically says you had two choices. You either went crazy, right? I mean, you couldn't handle what you were doing. And so the only way to survive was to disassociate yourself from what you were doing. And he uses those words. He said, "I turned myself into an unemotional robot. I went through the motions. I tried not to look. I tried not to pay attention. And I became numb to everything that I was doing." So there are those who knock the Sonderkommando, right? They're not among the moral elite of the camp. On the other hand, look what they had to see and do. They worked 12-hour shifts. They worked 12 hours of nonstop. One of the people in the book that I forget the name of right now, but I'm happy to share it with anyone. One of the interviews describes how when they would hear a transport pull into Auschwitz, they would cry. The Sonderkommando would cry because they knew what that would mean for them over the next 12 hours. I mean, just horrific, beyond horrific. Okay, another quote. This is from an eyewitness. "The Sonderkommando were often reproached for not having shown resistance. But did not we all obey orders without question? Their faces were blackened from burning wood and soot. Their wild and terrifying look was startled as that of a wild beast. All the inmates wanted to stay alive, and so did they." In other words, there were people who want to knock them. How did you not stand up? How did you not resist? How did you not fight back? And the answer is, you were in survival mode. You weren't thinking. You were going through the motions. You were doing what you had to do in order to get yourself to not only the next day, to the next minute, to the next second, to survive. That split second, you would do anything you had to do. And here, I think this is the most powerful one. It's split up into three slides. But this is from a survivor of Auschwitz. And she writes the following. I'm not even going to pretend I can say her name. Zarzyszka? Anyone? Okay. She writes, "Let no one judge another guilty who does not know the taste of hopelessness in the depths of extinction." You can't judge. I remember when I visited once with Harry Wanderer, a blessed memory. Harry, of course, is a Holocaust survivor. And he survived in the forests for months. I don't remember exactly how long. But I asked Harry, I said, "What did you eat in the forest?" And he said, "We ate whatever we could." I said, "What does that mean?" He said, "Whatever we could." I said, "What does that mean?" He said, "If you saw a rabbit, you ate the rabbit. That was how starved we were." He said, "You didn't ask questions. You didn't wonder about if you washed your hands first or if you boiled the rabbit. You just ate the rabbit. That's what you did to survive." So that's what she's saying here. You can't judge who do not have the taste of hopelessness in the depths of extinction. For what could they have done? Could they have told those newly arrived on the station platform that they were going to their death, that would have resulted in their dying in full and shocking knowledge of their fate. Right? Is it better that they would have warned those who were walking to the gas station, at least robbed them of their last few minutes on earth to enjoy? And we'll see some of the quotes later on, which will speak to this exact notion. But it would not have changed their fate, nor would it have managed to pass on to others far away the news of their elimination. Their attempts to rebel or protest would have been in vain and for naught. So you want them to rebel? What would that have done? That would have robbed people of any sense of hope at the end of their life. Why do that? You think they were going to escape? These people weren't escaping. She says in the next slide, even if... did I skip one?
No, you're okay.
I'm okay, but I'm not okay here. Oh, here we go. Even if they could have succeeded in momentarily saving someone from the hands of the SS, the entire area was surrounded with barbed wire fences, a ring of sentries, and beyond that, occupied Poland. The Germans enjoyed a limitless rule throughout, in a Jewish physiognomy. Sorry, Mom. I must have skipped that word in my SAT studies, right? Was tantamount to a death sentence. Free men become filled with anger when their peers refuse to take up arms in defense of their honor of their lives. But the Sonderkommando were prisoners in the dreadful days of death and shame in the huge death factory called Auschwitz. Do not hasten to judge. Okay? These were a complicated group of people, but it's not easy to judge them. And lastly, she says, no small number of these people became notoriously wild in the course of their work. These thought of nothing but the saving of their own skin in their own pleasure, such as the drinking to excess of alcoholic beverages brought with them by the condemned. Others became bestial. Their senses were dulled, and they became totally indifferent to their work. For evil does indeed engender evil. But the Germans did not succeed in corrupting them all. This can be attested to by living men who were saved throughout through the aid of the Sonderkommandos. So you have this very complicated group. You have those historically that knock them, that degrade them because of their unwillingness or perhaps inability to rise up, to fight back, to revolt, to do more to save Jews, to warn the Jews about their pending fate. And then you have others that defend them and say, you can't judge until you're in their situation, until you saw what they saw and smelled what they smelled and had to do the acts that they had to do every single day for 12 hours a day. You can't judge that. And while, yes, some of them did become bestial, because if you treat someone like an animal for long enough, they'll start acting like an animal. But he says there were some who rose above that and acted valiantly to save others through the aid of the Sonderkommandos. And that's what I want to talk about now for a few minutes. Not those who chose or who became bestial and vicious and evil because of the work that they were doing, but those who rose above it and were able to act with valor and with dignity even to their final days. So the Sonderkommandos did have a number of successes. Success number one was, there are cases, and again, I'm happy to share books where I researched a lot of this, but there were cases where they took the money and the jewelry that was found on corpses, and instead of giving it over to the Germans, they were able to smuggle it out of Auschwitz and to give it to the members of the Polish resistance movement. Do whatever you could do to help in whatever way you can. The next thing is that they were successful. There are four famous photographs that were smuggled out of Auschwitz. Okay, I forgot the name of the person who successfully smuggled them out, but there were four photographs and there was a revolt. And we're going to talk about the last two for a few minutes. Here are the four photographs, just so we should know. You have on the left-hand side pictures of the cremation of corpses. And I wavered back and forth whether to share these or not. But they're readily accessible, certainly on the internet. And I think they're important for what we're talking about. So you have the cremation of corpses. Those are the pictures on your left-hand side. The people standing are the Sonderkommando, are the ones who are responsible for the burning of the bodies. On the bottom right-hand side, you have a tree. Now, why do I think this tree is important? Because it's nothing. Right? Why would you take a picture of a tree from that angle? If you're... Right? What is it? What do you need to do to take a good picture?
You have to aim.
You have to aim. You have to focus. You need time. You need... If you're running around with a camera trying not to be seen, you're just taking whatever pictures you can. This was a picture of he's shooting from the hip, literally, which means he's not aiming. He's trying to remain hidden because obviously if he's caught taking pictures, he would be killed immediately. And that's why I think that picture is important. It shows a little bit of the reticence, the nervousness, the fear that the Sonderkommando had even taking these heroic pictures. In the left-hand side, is woman being taken to the gas chamber. In and of itself is a horrific picture, and I purposefully left that one the smallest to preserve the dignity of anyone who might be in that picture. So again, you have these four pictures. Now, these four pictures are heroic. Why are they heroic? Because one of the things that we're going to talk about as we build our class tonight to ultimately get to our personality of Rabbi Leib Langfuss is the Mesiras Nefesh. It's a word I'm going to come back to over and over and over again. Mesiras Nefesh means, it's a good translation, the self-sacrifice of the sacrifice, the willingness to die, to do dangerous things because it's the necessary thing and the right thing to do. And so here you have a success, the Sonderkommando took pictures, smuggled it out. Why? Because they didn't know that anyone around the world would ever know about what was taking place in Auschwitz. They didn't know that Auschwitz wouldn't be razed to the ground like other concentration camps and death camps were. They didn't know that there would ever be Jews ever again in the world to be able to tell the story of what took place on those grounds. And so if you're smuggling out pictures, it's because you want to be able to tell the story. And telling the story is what we're going to talk about tonight. That's incredibly important. And people risked their lives over and over and over again just to be able to tell the story. People who had nothing else to give to the world because they were going to be sent to the gas chamber at some point and they knew it, but they figured if we could just tell the world what happened so that history will know, that in and of itself was worthwhile of their Mesiras Nefesh, of their willingness to sacrifice their lives just to tell the story. And that's why these photographs are so important. And you'll see that ultimately is going to become very important when we talk about Rabbi Langfuss as well. 1944. Auschwitz has been running for 2.5 years about, right? Since the mass death camps. 3 years, okay? You have 663 men who are in the Sonderkommando at this point. 169 in each crematoria, 2, 3... and 4, and 156 in crematorium 5. Remember, 2 and 3 were over here, 4 and 5 are over there. October 7th, 1944, prisoners assigned to crematorium number 4, revolt. And they use gunpowder that was smuggled in, and they blow up crematorium number 4. On the right-hand side there, you have the picture of crematorium number 4. If you go to Auschwitz to this day, you have that. Off to this side, it didn't come in the picture, but there's a sign that tells you the story of this revolt on October 7th, 1944. One of the videos that we'll probably watch is describing how they smuggled in the gunpowder. Four women who worked in the gunpowder area, and there was a whole process of how they smuggled it in. After the Germans squashed the revolt, so they publicly hanged these four women. The testimony on one of the videos is the sister of one of those four women who had smuggled the gunpowder and was publicly hanged. And she describes, unbelievably, how her friends knew what was happening and they shielded her from seeing it. So she says, I heard the sounds, but my friends didn't want me to see what ultimately became her sister being hanged. Again, extraordinary Mesiras Nefesh. People willing to sacrifice their lives to give themselves a glimmer of hope. Okay? That's the revolt, October 7th, 1944. There are stories. It was largely unsuccessful. One of the people on that video, which we're not going to watch tonight, But one of the individuals on that video describes how he says that while the revolt and the uprising was largely unsuccessful, he happened to have been working in the furnaces that night, that day, and there was a capo and an SS soldier there, and he says that in the moment of craziness, they threw both the capo and the SS soldier right into the furnace, alive. He says that was the rage that they felt. Again, it was largely unsuccessful. If you read the testimonials of the Sonderkommando that survived, they describe how the Germans went around beating everyone and again getting people back into order. But again, it's important to realize that there were those who did revolt and there were those that did stand up. Testimony about the revolt. They set up a large shout. They're lined up, the Sonderkommando. That's what happens before this. So you have the SS soldiers and you have the Sonderkommando lined up. They hurled themselves upon the guards with hammers and axes, wounded some of them, the rest they beat with what they could get at. They pelted them with stones without further ado. It is easy to imagine what the upshot of this was. Few minutes had passed when a whole detachment of SS men drove in, armed with machine guns and grenades. There were so many of them that each had two machine guns for one prisoner. Even such an army was mobilized against them. So, obviously the Germans, and that's part of what was described. You want them to revolt? Do you not realize what the Germans had mobilized? How they would squash it in just a second? But again, it's important to understand the Mesiras Nefesh, the sacrifice that people were willing to take, even though they knew they would die, just to give themselves that glimmer of hope. All of this brings us to the scrolls of Auschwitz. One of the ways that people expressed their Mesiras Nefesh is by taking pictures and by telling the story that way. Another way that people expressed this Mesiras Nefesh was by writing down what they had seen as a testimonial, burying it under the ground of Auschwitz, hoping that someday someone would come and retrieve these testimonials and bring their stories back to life. These were found in the crematoria area. They were written by, well, we'll see in a second. There were six manuscripts that were found. Most of them were lost, either in burnings or looters who came to Auschwitz after it was liberated. Six of them were found. Three authors, Zalman Gradowski, Zalman Lowenthal, and Rabbi Leib Langfuss, our person that we are going to talk about tonight. Leib Langfuss's manuscripts are split up into two parts. One describes life in the, I assume, Bleczek labor camp. We'll read a little bit about that. And the other is a vivid description, a horrifically vivid description of what he saw and what took place in the crematorium, in the gas chambers, life in Auschwitz. What makes Rabbi Leib Langfuss so important to us is that he chose to tell the story. He's one of the few documents that we have of the Sonderkommando telling the story of what happened in the gas chambers contemporaneously. In other words, we have interviews with Sonderkommando after the war of them describing what they remember from those experiences. But Rabbi Leib Langfuss is a Sonderkommando during the concentration camps, describing as it was happening what it is that he was seeing. And that's what makes him so important to us. Because he is someone who risked his life, and make no mistake about it, he risked his life. If he was caught, he would have been killed on the spot. He risked his life to tell the story to future generations about the horrors of what took place in those crematoria in the gas chambers. Much of what we know is because of him. Many of the details, the stories, the vivid imagery, the emotion of what we know about the gas chambers, about the crematorium, is because he and people like him chose to risk their lives to tell us that story. And so, if you ask me what his legacy is, if you ask me why you and I are sitting here tonight talking about him, we should spend, right? I was talking to Carrie today. Carrie, of course, is Irish. So she said she was, I told her what I was talking about a little bit. So she researched on Google. It's some crazy number that if we said, if we had a moment of silence for every person who died in the Holocaust, it would be some like extraordinary number, right? 11 years, that was it, yeah. So halavai, we should be able to spend 11 years talking about each of the people. We can't. But to me, his legacy is, he represents a group of people that risk their lives to tell us a story. Okay? He writes here, this is not from him, this is Zalman Gradowski, but again, I think it's important. He writes, "Dear finder of these notes, I have one request of you, which is in fact the practical objective for my writing, that my days of hell, that my hopeless tomorrow will find a purpose in the future." That's all they wanted. They just wanted people to know. They wanted people to remember them. They wanted people to understand the hell that they went through. "I am transmitting only a part of what happened in Birkenau, Auschwitz, hell. You will realize what reality looked like. From all this, you will have a picture of how our people perished." They just wanted to tell the story. And while this is Zalman Gradowski, the same exact thing could be said for what Rabbi Leib Lankfus tried to accomplish. They just wanted to tell the story. They wanted us, 70 plus years later, to understand and to appreciate and to mourn and to remember. What do we know about Rabbi Leib Lankfus? What do we know about your uncle? What do you know about him? He was a big rabbi, held in high esteem.
I know that he assumed the Zion after my grandfather.
Correct. So what do we know? So he was born in Warsaw in about, they assume, either 1908, 1910, 1933 or 1934, he marries Devorah, who's the daughter of Dain Shmuel Yosef Rosenthal, who is the local rabbi of, anyone want to help me with that pronunciation?
Makov
Majwes. I don't know.
She called it Makov.
What did he say?
She called it Makov, my mother.
Makov? Okay, of Makov. We'll call it that. It's a lot easier. It actually exists on a map, so that's how I know it's there. Okay? Following marriage, like many people used to do back then, he moved in with the in-laws, so he settles in the same town. He's known as Der Makover Dayan. He was known as the Dayan of Makov, and they have a son named Shmuel. He studies in a very prestigious yeshiva, the Shuzmir Yeshiva, and pretty much biographically, that's really all we know about him, which is in and of itself part of the tragedy, right? That we know very little about this great, esteemed rabbi. And we know from writings and from testimonials that he was held in enormously high esteem. And I'll show you one practical example of how we know that in a little bit. November 18th, 1942, the Lankfus family, together with the entire population of Makov, around 3,500 people, the population in their town was about 7,000. So the Jews made up about a half of the population. Think about that. Half of the population is transported first to Malwa, which you see up, how do you pronounce it?
Lawa,
which is to the west, and then on December 7th to Auschwitz, and on December 10th to Birkenau. Okay? Lankfus, his wife, and his son were amongst these group who were transported, and immediately upon arrival at Birkenau, his wife and his son are gassed. I went on the Yad Vashem website. There are a lot of Lankfuses. I couldn't find Devorah or Shmuel. Maybe I was looking incorrectly. But again, from everything that we know, including his own testimony, so his wife and his son were murdered in Auschwitz. Okay, there were 3,000 people, 70 of which were chosen for the Sonderkommando, and Rabbi Leib Lankfus was one of those chosen for the Sonderkommando. How do we know that he was held in such high esteem? He was protected. It wasn't easy to be protected in Auschwitz when you were a Sonderkommando, but he was protected. And what does that mean, he was protected? He was shielded from having to do some of the most gruesome and horrific acts as a Sonderkommando. He was never forced to be there when people were being rushed to the gas chambers. This is a quote from him. We'll see it later on. He says, on principle, I was never present when the Jews were being rushed to their... I was never present when the Jews were being rushed to their death. Better than my wife texting me in the class. Right? I was never present when the Jews were being rushed to their death, as it might have come to pass that the SS would force me to carry out their murderous purposes in the crematorium. He did not want to obviously participate in it. I would imagine no one wanted to participate in it. But because he was a rabbi held in high esteem, those around him helped him, and they shielded him from some of the most gruesome activities. You have conversations. I couldn't get them off, but if you Google, there are books, manuscripts of testimonials where people describe their philosophical, theological conversations with Rabbi Langfuss. There aren't a lot of them. One in particular, I didn't share it because I couldn't validate it. And I couldn't get the whole book. And unless I get the book and I can validate its source, I didn't want to share it with you because it has a little bit of a troubling ending. It has there that Rabbi Langfuss and he are talking about why bad things happen to good people. And the person is unsatisfied with Rabbi Langfuss's answer. And he describes how because of that, he was very troubled. So I didn't want to share it because I couldn't testify to the veracity of it. So I left it out. But you do have testimonials about that. He most likely dies after November 26, 1944. Why? Because the last writing in his diary is from that date. And in that writing, he describes how they know that their death is imminent. Now, how do they know that their death was imminent? Because one of the things the Nazis did was they rotated the Sonderkommando on a regular basis. And when I say rotate, I meant you rotated in, you didn't rotate out. There was only one out. And that was that you yourself were being gassed. And that's they did that every couple of months because they wanted to prevent any revolt. If you change it up frequently, people can't mobilize. People can't build connections on the outside. People can't communicate very easily. So that's how we, in all likelihood, know that he died somewhere close after November 26, 1944. He writes here the following. This is from a quote from Philip Mueller, who is also a member of the Sonderkommando, describing a conversation that he had heard or had with Rabbi Leib Langfuss. And this is from his biography. He writes, "We should be alone, without a family, without relatives, without friends, without a place we might call our own, condemned to roam the world aimlessly. For us, there would be neither peace nor a rest of mind until one day we would die in some corner, lonely and forsaken. Therefore, brothers, let us now go to meet death bravely and with dignity." In other words, to be a Jew is to be lonely. It's to be persecuted. He's describing the history of our people. And how does he end? Right? Go to our deaths with dignity and bravely. Right? You would imagine him, and again, we have other testimonials of him doing such things, giving, so to speak, pep talks to the people as they're going to their death, trying to build them up, trying to give them hope, trying to give context to what they are about to endure. There's a book by Bear Mark called The Scrolls of Auschwitz, which describes the writings of Zalman Gradowski, Zalman Lowenthal, and in that book, Bear translates from Yiddish into English a few pages of Rabbi Leib Langfuss's diary. And that's what I want to read with you a little bit tonight. So if you take out your packet. Now, this is all in English. We're not going to read all of it. And you're welcome to read on your own later on. I just want to read some of it, maybe a lot of it. I don't even know how to describe emotionally what I felt reading this. Some of it is gruesome. All of it is horrific. Some of it might give you nightmares, and I apologize in advance. But I think we have to read it. And we have to read it for the same reason that my mother told me to go to school on Yom HaShoah. And the reason why we have to read it is because Rabbi Langfuss died so that you and I would have firsthand accounts of the horrors that took place, that those stories would never be forgotten. That 75 years later, 100 years later, 200 years later, people would know that there was the worst most bestial evil in the world existed in Poland. And if he didn't tell the story, and if we don't tell the story, then the stories die out with the people. And that's our job. Our job is to make sure that these stories continue to be told. So we're not reading these because we're voyeurs. We're not reading these because it's interesting. We're reading it because this is what he died for. This is what he lived for. This is what he was doing. You picture him going back to the barracks at night, smuggling a quill and a pen and a piece of paper to be able to write this down, just so that you and I could read these stories and know about evil, and in certain circumstances know about faith, and in certain circumstances know about hope, all of which is contained within these. So if you look at number one, I tried to number them so we could jump around paragraph to paragraph. I skipped a couple of the paragraphs, either because they are particularly inappropriate for a public setting, or because for time purposes. Number one, two Hungarian Jews asked the Sonderkommando, should we say the confession, revidoi, what a person says before they're about to die? He replied in the affirmative, which in and of itself should give you goosebumps. They then pulled out bottles of brandy and drank happily, raising their bottles l'chaim. They actively persuaded the Sunder commander to drink with them. The man was ashamed and refused to drink. They persisted, you have to avenge our blood. You have to live. So to life. Can you imagine? They know they're about to die, but they said, you're about to live. To life. L'chaim. You have to tell our story. They appealed to him. We understand how you feel. And he drank with them. While drinking, the man became very emotional and burst out weeping. He ran into the crematorium and sobbed bitterly for a long time. Comrades, we have burned enough Jews. Now let us destroy everything in ourselves as well for the sanctification of God's name. I love that story. I don't love that story, but I appreciate that story because it testifies to the hope, to the optimism, to the resolve of people that are about to be sent to their death, making a l'chaim because the Sonder commando is going to have to be the one to tell their story. Absolutely extraordinary. Next one, number two. End of summer 1943. A group of Poles from the immediate vicinity was brought to the camp. All its members, including 12 young women, were members of the underground organization. A rank of SS men marched into the camp. At the same time, several hundred Dutch Jews from among the camp inmates were brought to be killed by gas. In the gas chamber, in the gas bunker, totally naked, a young woman made an impassioned speech against the German murders and the oppressors, concluding with the words, "We will not die. Our memory will be immortalized in the history of our people. Our initiative and our spirit live and bloom. The German people will pay an incalculable price for our blood. Down with the barbarism and the image of Nazi Germany. Long live Poland." She then turned to the Jewish Sonderkommandos and said, "Remember, your sacred purpose is to avenge our innocent blood. Tell the brothers of our people that we are going to our death with pride and profound consciousness." The Poles then knelt and formally, in an impressive pose, whispered a prayer. Still on their knees, they sang the Polish national anthem in chorus. The Jews sang Hatikva. Their common cruel fate joined in that cursed place the lyric notes of the two anthems so different from one another. Movingly and heartily, they expressed their last emotions and their consolation in their people's future. They then sang the Internationale. Meanwhile, the Red Cross vehicle had arrived and gas was thrown into the bunker. They passed away in the midst of their song, born on the wings of a dream of brotherhood in a better world. Just an extraordinary image of Jews singing Hatikva, singing a song of hope, singing a song of optimism. If only they could have imagined that 5 years later, Jews would have a homeland, that we'd have a country, that we'd have an army, that we'd have an Israel. It's extraordinary to think of. There's no way we can do justice to all of these. You could spend a half hour just digesting all of this, but we're going to do our best. Number three, end of 1944, transport arrived from Slovakia. The arrivals knew without a doubt that they were being taken to their death. Nevertheless, they were calm. They undressed and entered the bunker. As they were leaving the dressing room and entering the gas chamber, a woman said, "Maybe a miracle will still happen." Unbelievable, right? Foolishness, naivety, hopefulness, optimism, all of the above. I'm not sure, but it's extraordinary. Number four, end of 1943. This was a transport of Jews from Tarna. They inquired where they were being taken. They were told they would be liquidated. They were already standing naked. A heavy, serious mood overtook them all. They became lost in thought and whispered the confession, Vidoy, for the sins of the past. All of their emotions had become dulled, and only one thought stunned and electrified them, the need to take account of their souls before extinction. Right? A cheshbon ha-nefesh. They're about to meet their creator. Meanwhile, another group of Jews had arrived from Tarna. One of the young people sat on a bench and asked for everyone's attention. A deathly silence prevailed. My Jewish brothers, he called out, do not believe that they are taking you to your death. It is unthinkable that this can happen to us, that tens of thousands of innocent men will be put to death. Such cruel and shocking slaughter could never happen in this world. Those who told you these things must have their reasons. Right? Same way we can't believe it. They couldn't believe it. Who does that to human beings? Even standing naked in Auschwitz, they couldn't believe that such cruelty was possible. He continued to speak until he had calmed down. Only when the gas was thrown into the bunker did the preacher, with his well-developed conscience, awaken from the dream of innocence. The pretext that had used to calm his brothers were shown to be mere illusion and self-deception. But this realization had come too late. Even until the last second, they could not fathom that mankind was capable of such vicious, vicious cruelty. Number five. Let's skip a little bit. Number six. This one is amazing. Amazing. I don't know what to do with this. I'm haunted by this one, as you'll see in a second. In the last days of 1944, all right, it's double-sided, so number six. In the last days of 1944, by the way, number five is amazing also, and I feel bad not reading it, so you should read it on your own, okay? Number six. In the last days of May 1944, a transport arrived from someplace. Kozhets. The deportees included the old Rebbetzin of Strapkov, who was already 85 years old. She said, "Only now do I see the extinction of the Jews of Hungary. The government permitted significant portions of the Jewish community to escape, but when the Jews asked the advice of their rabbis, they calmed down. The rabbi of Belz said that the Jews of Hungary would know nothing worse than fear." In other words, he convinced people to stay. "Until the better day suddenly came when the Jews were thrown into hell. Oh yes, the heavenly ones concealed it from them, but at the last minute, they alone escaped to the land of Israel. They saved their own souls, leaving their flocks to be slaughtered. Lord of the universe, in the last moments of my life, I ask you to forgive them for the desecration of your name." Wow. In the last moments of your life, Hashem, forgive the rabbis who convinced us to stay while they went to Israel. I know Rabbi Blumenthal spoke about that last year, but that just gives you chills. That's just crazy. Number seven. End of winter 1943, a transport arrived consisting entirely of children who had been picked up in prowling cars from their mothers' houses while their fathers were working. The Commandofer sent one of his men to undress the smaller children. A girl of about 8 years old, who was undressing her little brother, said to the man, "Go away, you Jewish murderer! Don't put your hand covered in Jewish blood on my sweet brother. I am his good mother now, and he will die in my arms." A boy of 7 and 8 standing near them said, "You are a Jew. How will you be allowed to lead these pure Jews to the gas only to save yourself? Your life among the gangs of murderers, is your life amongst the gangs of murderers dearer than the lives of so many Jewish victims? Can you imagine That's what she said to the Sunder Commando? You think your life is better than me? That you're going to lead our lives to death? Can you imagine being the Sunder Commando, having to do that, having to listen to that? The emotions that were experienced in those moments when Jews looked at their fellow Jews who were escorting them to their death and not doing anything about it? That's the story of the Sunder Commando. 8 we'll skip for a second, although it's important because it's from the Belgic camp. Turn the page. Where am I? Oh, here we go. Number 9. 9, 10, and 11 are unreal. 9 is from the end of his diary. He writes the following. Again, you see there's something on October 14th, which was when? That's right after the failed uprising. Okay? There's one on October 20th. There's one on November 25th. And he writes the following. I would request that my various writings of the past, signed with the initials AJRA. Now, he never signs his name to this, but AJRA stands for Aryeh Leib Regel Arucha. Aryeh Leib is Rab Leib Langfus. What's Regel Arucha? Langfus. Now, why would you sign it that way? He didn't want to be caught. Right? Remember how dangerous this was. If the Germans had dug up his manuscripts or had found his manuscripts and attributed it to his name, he would be dead. And so he writes in code so that even if they were to find it, they wouldn't know it was him. Aryeh Leib Regel Arucha. Langfus. Langfoot. Langfus. Okay? And buried in... I request that my various writings of the past, signed with initials AJRA, and buried in jars and boxes in the courtyard of crematorium number 2, be collected, as well as 2 larger writings, one titled The Deportation, hidden in the bone pit of crematorium 1, among writing titled Auschwitz. The latter was hidden in a heap of bones on the southwest side of the courtyard. Right, he's giving us a map of where to find. Again, this is his legacy. He knows he's going to his death, and all he wants is for his manuscripts to survive him. I later recopied them and completed them, and they were separately buried in the ashes of crematorium 2. I would request that they be edited and published together under the title The Horrors of Murder. We are now going to the sauna. The 170 remaining men. We are convinced that they are taking us to our death. They have selected 30 men to remain in crematorium 4. Today is November 26th, 1944. And that is the last entry in the diary of Rabbi Leib Langfus. 2 other extraordinary excerpts from his diary. One is titled The 600 Boys. And it's exactly that. It's gruesome, but the end is unbelievable. At noon, 600 Jewish boys of 12 to 18 years old were brought in, dressed in long striped camp clothing, light and torn. They wore shoes and wooden clogs on their feet. The children were so beautiful, well-formed and seeming to shine in their rags. This was during the second half of October 1944. They were led by 22 armed SS men. As they came into the courtyard, the commandant ordered them to undress in the courtyard. When the children saw the clouds of smoke, they realized at once they were being taken to their death. They began to run in all directions within the courtyard, mad with fear, pulling out their hair, and not knowing how to save themselves. Many of them began crying in terror, and they started to howl. The commandant and his assistants beat the children savagely. In order to force them to undress, they beat them until the club broke, and then they replaced it with another. And the man continued to beat the helpless children on the head. The strong men won. The women undressed, instinctively frightened to death, naked and barefoot. They clung to each other to protect each other from the blows. And yet, they still did not go in. One brave boy approached us and asked the commandant to let him live. He said he would do any task, even the hardest of labor. The answer was a blow from a club on the boy's head. Again, they start running around. Look at the end. three lines up from the bottom. The SS men chased them, rushing and whipping until they had taken control of the situation and finally shoved them inside. They were unimaginably happy. Were none of them ever fathers of children? That's Rabbi Langfuss writing. He sees it and he wonders, how can someone treat children this way? Do they not have children of their own? A sense of humanity, even amongst the Sonderkommando. How do you do that? How do you understand that? How do you do that to another human being? In the last famous of his journal diaries, which I don't know why I'm having trouble finding this right now, it's called The 3,000 Naked Women. Now we're going to skip the beginning of it and the middle of it, because again, it's not all, again, you can read it on your own. But 11 I found to be the most powerful, and that's why I'm saving it for last. Again, the Sonderkommando, Rabbi Langfuss, they're sitting there, they're watching all of this. They're the last people that these Jews are seeing before being taken to their death. And listen to this interaction. A young woman became hysterically. They examined our faces. Who's the our? The Sonderkommando. They examined our faces, looking for an expression of sympathy. One stood in a corner and looked deep into the depths of these poor, helpless souls. Right? One of the Sonderkommando is sitting off in the corner, and he's just staring at them. He could no longer control himself and burst out crying. A young girl then said, "Ah, I have been privileged to see before I die an expression of sorrow, a tear of sympathy at our sad fate in this camp of murderers in which so many are tortured, beaten, and killed, in which people see so many murders and interminable horrors, in a camp where our senses become dull and petrified at the sight of the worst horrors, where every human emotion dies to the extent that you can see your brother or sister fall and not even sigh. Yes, here can there be a man who will still feel our disaster, who will weep for our fate? Oh, what a wonderful vision. How unnatural." This girl is so excited that she's seeing human emotion, that she's seeing someone who feels their pain, that she's seeing someone who cries a tear for them. "The tear of a Jew, of a live Jew, will go with me to my death. The sight of a sensitive man." That's all she wanted. She just wanted someone to, it's amazing. "There is still someone who will mourn us. And I had thought that we would leave this world like miserable orphans. I find a bit of comfort in this young man among people who are all murderers and criminals. I have found before my death a man with feelings." She turned away from us, leaning her head against the wall, and from the depths of her heart came quiet, bitter tears. Her heart dissolved within her. Around her sat and stood many young women, their heads bowed, unspeaking. Their expression showed disgust at this lowly world and especially at us. Again, the guilt that he's feeling as a member of the Sonderkommando. One said, "I am still young. I have not yet known the taste of life. Why has it been decreed for me to die this way? Why?" She spoke slowly in a broken voice, sighed deeply, and continued, "And I want to live so much." She finished speaking dreamily and tenderly, her eyes fixed on empty space. And like wildfire, the fear of impending death split in the air. Her friend looked at her with a sarcastic smile and said, "The happy moment I have dreamed of has finally arrived. When the heart is full of pain and suffering, imprisoned in a world of horrors and murder, in the crudest meanness, unlimited lowliness of evil, life becomes hard, difficult, and unbearable to the point where I look forward to death as a liberator, as freedom. The nightmare hovering over me and depressing me will disappear forever." To me, that imagery of the girl who just craved humanity. She just wanted someone to showcase empathy, to shed a tear for her, to mourn with her, to tell her story. That's the vision, that's the joy, so to speak, that she brought with her as she went to her death. And that ultimately is what gave her comfort. And that, my friends, is what we know about Rabbi Leib Langfuss. A man that we really don't know a lot about. We know that he's ends up in Auschwitz. We know that he's a member of the Sonderkommando. We know, even from just the readings, you sense the way he describes the people looking at him. He feels judged. He feels guilty over his role and his inability to act. That's at least what I sense into reading it. The way he describes how they looked at them, right? The haunting stares of people about to go to their death. And to me, his lasting legacy is what he was Moser Nefesh for. If you think back to what he wrote, All I Want, he tells us where all of his manuscripts are, because what he wants more than anything else is to tell the story. Not because this is going to make it into some class, but so that Jews, for eternity, would be able to tell the stories of people who can no longer tell it themselves. And that, to me, is an enormous legacy. Make no mistake about it. We might not have his rabbinic writings. We might not have response of his. We might not have writings of deep philosophical conversations. Make no mistake about it. What he did was heroic. We are better off because of it. History is better off because of it. And through his writings, he brings these people and these stories back to life in a little small way. By telling their story, by making sure that people forever will understand and appreciate the horrors and the viciousness and the evil that was experienced in the death camps of Auschwitz. I want to end with a Dvar Torah that I think really captures the thesis that I've been trying to present. The Gemara describes that when Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, three Jews living in Babel in Babylonia in the time of Nebuchadnezzar, so Nebuchadnezzar asks all the Jews to bow down to, everyone to bow down to an idol of himself. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah refuse to do it. Nebuchadnezzar is furious, and so he builds a bonfire. And he brings over Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, who are three friends of Daniel, and he says, if you don't bow down to this idol, I'm throwing you into the fire. And they say, we're not bowing down. And he throws them into the fire. Of course, it's one of the miracles in the story of Daniel. And they emerge unscathed. The Gemara says, how do they know to do that? How do they know that they're supposed to voluntarily give up their life rather than bow down to the idol? How do they know that you're supposed to have that sense of mesiras nefesh, that sense of sacrifice? And so the Gemara says, they learned it out from the frogs. What frogs? The frogs in Egypt. We tell the song, frogs here, frogs there, frogs are really everywhere. What's a pasuk in the Torah? Torah describes the frogs literally went everywhere. They went to the beds and on the heads. And one of the places that the Torah describes the frogs went was into the ovens. And the Gemara says the same way that the frogs went into the ovens and killed themselves for the sanctification of God's name, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah deduced that they too should go into fire for the sanctification of God's name. Ask the Vilna Gaon a very simple question. There's a difference between the two of them. The frogs weren't voluntarily going into the ovens. It's a pasuk in the Torah that Hashem told them to go into the ovens. Hashem said, you have to be here, there, everywhere. They didn't volunteer to go into the ovens and die al kiddush Hashem for the sanctification of God's name. God commanded them to go into the ovens. So ask the Vilna Gaon, how can you compare the two cases? One was voluntary, one was not voluntary. And the Grug gives an amazing answer. He says, the frogs as a whole were commanded to go into a lot of different places. Some of them had to go into the kitchen, some of them had to go into the TV room, some of them had to go into Paro's bed, and some of them had to go into the oven. Every single frog could have said the following. Why do I have to be the one to go into the oven? I'll be the one to go into Paro's bed. It's a lot safer over there. What do I have to give my life? Let the other guy do it. Why do I have to be the guy to kill himself? Why me? And says the Vilna Gaon, that's what Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah learned from the frogs. They learned from the frogs that sometimes the answer or the response of why me, let someone else sanctify God's name, let someone else do it, is not an acceptable response for a Jew. History is replete. History is filled with Jews who never allowed why me to be a valid excuse. History is replete of Jews who stepped forward, sacrificed and sanctified their life in God's name to bring a little bit more of Hashem into this world. And that is the legacy of Hanan and Mishael and Azariah sells the Vilna Gaon, and that's what they learned out from the frogs. When I thought of this Dvar Torah, I thought of Rabbi Leib Langfuss, an individual who very easily could have said, let me cover my own skin, save my own tuchus, and let someone else be the one who's going to tell the story. Why do I have to risk my life? Why do I have to put my life on the line? If I'm caught, I'll be killed immediately. Let someone else tell the story. Let someone else figure it out. So much of what we learned tonight, and the stories that we read, and so much of what this entire series is about, are individuals that never allowed why me to be an excuse, but said, why not me? If not me, who is going to tell these stories? If I don't risk everything by writing down the story of faith and hope and optimism and tragedy and evil, then who's going to tell the story in a contemporaneous fashion? They didn't know that people would survive Auschwitz and be able to give testimonials. They didn't know that there would be anything called a survivor. They had no reason to believe that the Germans would allow anyone to live. And so this was an enormous act of sacrifice, saying, if I don't do it, nobody is going to tell the story. And to me, that is the ultimate heroic legacy of Rabbi Leib Langfuss. Everyone have...